Hello, and welcome to another edition of Radio Free Press. That's what we're doing this week. I'm Bill Houston,
and I'm Mike Hudak.
Here with Mike. And we've also got Kevin Bunger here in the studio. And Mike, how are you doing today?
Okay, Bill.
Very good. Mike, today we're going to be doing a show on corporations and corporate personhood. And we've got as our guest today, we've got Mr. Richard Grossman. You know, Mike, many people today feel a loss of control over their own lives. You know, often this feeling is general and vague, and people don't really know exactly the source of their malaise. You know, while we are free to vote, somehow our candidates do not seem to represent us. Our most cherished principles have been usurped and co-opted. For example, freedom has been equated with freedom of consumer choice. And while we have a constitutional guarantee to free speech, our information channels seem overloaded with speech which is mostly mindless or promoting things which does not represent our values or the best interest of living things on the planet. Today we have as our guest Mr. Richard L. Grossman, who has been described as the man who sparked the modern anti-corporate movement. Grossman is a researcher and a writer for the Massachusetts-based Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, also known as POCLAD, which he co-founded in 1994. Grossman graduated from Columbia University in 1965. Grossman served in the Peace Corps in the Philippines in the mid-1960s and was a safe energy anti-nuclear activist in California in the early 1970s. He acted as an educator and a writer in Washington, D.C. In 1976, he returned to Washington, D.C. to become director of Environmentalists for Full Employment, a position he held until 1985. During this time, he authored Energy, Jobs, and the Economy, and Fear at Work, Job, Blackmail, Labor, and the Environment. And throughout the 1980s, Grossman worked with Greenpeace, where he served as executive director, and the Highlander Center. He was co-founder of the Highlander Center's Stop the Poisoning Schools in Newmarket, Tennessee. In 1985, he became a guest fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and began publishing the Wrenching Debate Gazette, an environmental newsletter. In 1993, Grossman co-authored the pamphlet Taking Care of Business, Citizenship, and the Charter of Incorporation, which really broke ground in this area of understanding problems with corporations. In around 1995, Grossman co-founded with Ward Morehouse the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, which studies the way corporations have become intrusive into the day-to-day operations of government and seeks ways to unentangle the two institutions so that individual citizens, not corporations, govern the country. POCLAD publishes a quarterly newsletter, By What Authority?, and has published two books, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, and Elite Consensus. Mr. Grossman, are you with us?
I am.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
We had a little bit of trouble with the phones, I understand, but I'm glad we finally got them resolved. So, Richard, let me just, I'd like to start out the program on a kind of a provocative note, and before we really get into the whole history of things here. But Benito Mussolini said that fascism should be more appropriately called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Would you agree with that, and would you say that we are living in a fascist state?
Well, Franklin Roosevelt said something similar about the merging of what he called private power controlling public power. I think that's how he put it. And to him, that was fascism. And I think we have an awful lot of private power controlling public power. I think we live in a corporate state, yes. And I think if it was 1830 and people were asking what kind of state we lived in and people answered we live in a slave nation, I think that would be just as accurate. In that, what I mean is that the way things are ordered and structured is to ensure the supremacy of the corporations now, as it were, as things were structured to secure the supremacy of the slave masters in the 1830s.
Would you say that the slave masters have the same character, but maybe they've just changed form since then till now?
No, I think there's an awful lot that's different, but I think the similarities are that it's a relatively small class of people who are able to, in those days, were able to wield the coercive power of the state and of the culture for their principles and their values. And that meant denying the massive amounts of people their fundamental rights. And I think today we have a relatively small number of people working through corporations, a class of people, who also are able to use the coercive force of government and the law of the land and the rule of law to impose their values and to deny a majority of people their fundamental rights.
Now,
I wonder if your listeners think that's really provocative or most people would agree. I'd be very curious to know.
You know, we've got all these founding documents in our country, like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. You know, the second paragraph says, governments were instituted among men which derived their just power from the consent of the governed. And, you know, the preamble for the Constitution talks about we the people. Yet you've written, you co-wrote an essay which appeared in the fall 2000, By What Authority?, entitled Rumors of USA Democracy Discovered to be Counterfeit. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, when a minority rules, you don't have a democracy. I think we have a minority that rules here.
Is it the minority of, is it a plutocracy? Is it the rich, or is it the investor class, the capitalist class?
It's generally a corporate class. There's some very wealthy families too. But pretty much it's what we could call the corporate class, since the corporation is the dominant institution of our time, and we have a corporate class that really exercises governing power and authority in this country, which is why it's so difficult for citizens, even citizens who organize together and invest a huge amount of time and energy, to make really substantial changes in public policy and public law from the very beginning. I mean, think how long it took to get rid of slavery. Think of how long it took, how many generations for women to get the right to vote. Think of how many generations to get child labor laws. You know, how long does it take to close or do something with a company that's pouring out, you know, thousands of pounds or tons of toxic chemicals into the air and the water every day? It takes a very long time to change policy. And that's because the document, the Constitution, the document that you, one of the documents you mentioned, is a document, it's a plan of governance to enable a minority of people to control the majority.
Now, let me ask you, you just mentioned, corporations that are involved in polluting the environment. And I've see, you know, as I researched your biography, that you have quite a bit of work in the area of environmental study and environmental activism, including your work with Greenpeace. Would you say that your work in these areas has somehow influenced you into exploring the corporate form?
Well, it's more than that. I started off in the employment field and worked back in the 60s, actually. I worked a lot in communities with people having difficulty finding jobs, with what were called at-risk populations. And when I was in Washington, including migrant workers and poor urban workers, and when I was in Washington with Environmental Civil Employment that you mentioned, we were sort of crossing over, joining both the labor side and the environmental side. And I think that's characterized my work life. That the two big issues have been worker rights and earth rights, environmental rights. And my sort of hands-on experience in those realms, retrospectively, was quite logical. Brought me to the doors of corporate boardrooms and to the Constitution and to all the stuff that Polkett has been looking at. Because even, as I was suggesting before, even when people organize like crazy and even pass laws over the course of many years to try to remedy the situation that they were in, it became clear that the victories were were not sufficient, and that something else was going on, and that the people within the corporations behind this corporate shield were, you know, every time, in every issue, in every campaign, were waging, were wielding far more power, you know, disproportionate to their numbers, than the masses of people who were, you know, organizing to stop something or to try to translate their vision into some kind of positive public policy. I remember when I worked in California, I worked on the first statewide anti-nuclear initiative back in the mid-70s. And, you know, we all took it for granted that, you know, the largest contributors to the other side were virtually every major corporation in the country, and banks and all of that. And we all took it for granted that they could pour in these, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars into to dwarf the money that we were able to raise among people. And we, you know, we never questioned that, but I mean, that's one of the things that we began to question, you know, 20 years later. I mean, why is that the norm? Why should, if people want to do an initiative to pass a law in a country that's supposed to be about consent of the governed, why is it that it's perfectly legal and normal and accepted in the culture for corporations to pour their millions of dollars into the village square, into the body politic, in order to drown out the voices of human beings, in order to deny people their rights to speak?
Let's start with let's go back to the basics and talk about first principles. When we speak about a corporation, what exactly are we talking about? Is it a legal entity, a political entity?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. On one level, it's a creation of the state. It's a legal entity. It's a bundle of rights. It's a, you know, concoction of the state. It enables a few people to come together and pool the resources of many people. And if you do that today, as soon as you become a corporation, as soon as some people pay a fee and file the forms with the state and become a corporation, because of the history that we've had in this country, immediately that entity or the people within that entity, clothed by the corporate shield, are able to exercise more rights under the Constitution, more power than ordinary people. So on one level, the corporation is, you know, a commercial enterprise if it's formed in order to make money or to make a product. But on another level, the corporation, as it's evolved in this country, and as some of the early corporations in the 17th century, like the East India Company, they are governing entities. They are entities created in order to impose certain values and certain ways of life upon other people. And to the extent that they're backed by the state, they're successful. So I think, you know, a corporation is not just a business enterprise or a charitable entity or an educational institution. The corporation, the corporate form in the United States in the 21st century is a governing entity. And it exercises the prerogatives of governance.
Very interesting. Systems of government disguised as commercial entities.
Or as charitable entities, or as, you know, some of the think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and stuff, or the Chamber of Commerce, which is I don't know exactly what that's clarified, but that's a non-profit corporation. And it is, you know, the lobbying and propaganda arm of the other governing corporations. So, you know, they're different forms, but, you know, they're especially the large ones, but some of the small ones play it out all the time. Their role is to impose their view and to often impose a certain way of, you know, values and projects. You know, you look at any community, say, that's resisting some kind of corporate project, whether it's a quarry or a toxic dump or a factory or a Walmart store, and you'll dissect that struggle, I think it becomes pretty obvious that those corporate entities are seeking to be ruling entities. They're seeking to impose their will upon a community. One other thing I would add, that the corporation is also a minority governing entity internally. That is, you may have thousands of stockholders and thousands of employees, but a few people effectively govern the corporation. And so it's a strange institution to be sort of the model institution for the country. It is inherently an anti-democratic organization, and that is sanctioned by the law.
So it's anti-democratic really in two ways. Number one, the people at large have no voice in the operation of the corporation, but also the people even working for the corporation, by and large, don't have a voice.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
More than by and large, if you're a corporate employee, the moment you walk onto corporate property, you give up your constitutional rights. I mean, you have no First Amendment freedom of speech. You have no Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable searches. If your boss requires as a condition of work that you provide a urine test every day, you have no remedy to that. Either you do or you won't work there.
Well, let's talk about the history of how this happened, because wasn't it true that in the early... Let's talk about the early part of this country, the American Revolution. In one of your essays, I believe it was Revoking the Corporation, you kind of suggested that you talk about the Massachusetts Bay Company, the Virginia Company, the Carolina Company, the Maryland Corporation, Pennsylvania Corporation. You kind of suggest that the American Revolution at that time might have been a revolution against or rebellion against corporate rule. Would you say that's accurate?
I think people at that time were very clear that the corporations that you mentioned, at least the Massachusetts, the Carolina companies, could add the East India Company, that they were very aware of the nature of these entities. They had first-hand experience. Those were commercial ventures to come to the North America to make money. And they were private entities. There was not a concept that they were to be run by the majority, that people had rights. Consent of the governed was not an extant concept. And so I think the revolution was a complicated process. I think there were some people who, particularly after the Declaration of Independence, actually believed that the men of property who were leading the revolution believed in consent of the governed. It's clear that the men who ended up writing the Constitution believed in consent of the governed of the governing class, because that's who they wrote into the Constitution, and they denied the majority of people many rights in the Constitution. So that between the Declaration of Independence and the war and the ratification of the Constitution in 1791, you had a sort of a crackdown by men of property, basically revealing that their real goal was to be rid of absentee ownership and control, whether it was by English corporations or by the English King and Parliament. And they did that successfully, and for that they had to involve an awful lot of people for the struggle in the war. But once that was over, then they consolidated their authority over the 13 states to form a government where, a plan of government that they could basically control, and that they would hope their descendants would be able to control.
Now, is it true that that Thomas Jefferson was an advocate for an amendment to the Constitution which banning monopolies in commerce, which some people have interpreted to mean that would have banned most corporations as we know it?
I've seen reference to that, yes, in many places, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we had the revolution, and just to sum up what I believe you said, that despite all of the rhetoric in a lot of our founding documents about the rule of the people, you believe that the Constitution as structurally instilled the rights into the class of property owners.
Well, we have a couple hundred years of experience, of practical experience, and we have the language in the Constitution, which is sometimes vague, but we certainly have a lot of experience in the way it's been used and the way, for example, the Supreme Court has functioned. And again, to go back to what I said before, how long it took for active, organized, cross-generational movements, A, to ban slavery, B, even after people drove these extraordinary 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments into the Constitution, to take another 100 years to get rid of Jim Crow, to get the women not to get the right to vote until, 1919, effectively for African Americans to have the right really to vote until the 1970s. Why did this take so long? And I think there are a lot of people who agree or pretty confident that the nature of the Constitution itself is about enabling, as I said, a relatively small class of people to make the rules, for making the rules as well as making the rules. And then also we got to think, you know, while all those classes of people that were denied rights in the beginning, African Americans, women, white workers without property, Native peoples, they started off without rights at all and, you know, had to struggle, and still many are still struggling, but, you know, for quite a while. And so the laws, the precedents, the constitutional interpretations that the courts gave really helped to entrench that power and make it even more difficult, even once, you know, the majority of people got their basic rights. We still come up against laws and precedent and custom and ways of looking at things, language, that still make it incredibly difficult to impose the values that large numbers of people, oftentimes the majority, would like to have in this country.
Now, Richard, if one reads the many state constitutions, for example, the New York State Constitution, there is specific language in there that talks about that people have rights or guarantee of rights against infringements by governments or corporations. Clearly, in the early days of this country, there was at least somewhat of an attempt to make corporations subordinate to the will of the people, or the will of the people through a Republican or a Democratic form of government.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you would agree that today, it seems like the power has been transferred into this corporate form. How exactly did this change happen?
There never was a day when this country was a true democracy that was governed by the majority. So as we mentioned before, in the beginning, the power was in the hands of basically southern slaveholders and northern men of property, white men of property. And they didn't need the corporation as a governing vehicle. I mean, some of them used corporations, but not much. But they had the government. They were pretty much, you know, the Constitution was their plan of governance, and it denied most people their rights, and, you know, it was pretty good deal. As people began to struggle, as slavery was abolished, as the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments were enacted, as labor started to mobilize, and as slavery was over, then I think that the men of property in the North particularly realized that they needed a governing institution, and the corporation was the ideal thing for them. And so they quite logically sought to clothe the corporate form in the same constitutional rights that white men of property had clothed themselves in with the writing of the Constitution. So I think the transition went from a slave state to a corporate state, from slave masters to corporate managers. That's the real transition in terms of where the power went. So it's not like the majority of people ever had the authority to do the governing in this country and somehow lost it to the corporation. The way was paved, given the nature of the slave state. And after the Civil War in the 1870s and 80s, we went through a little transition, but we came out where, by the end of the 19th century, basically, corporations had been redefined as the dominant entity under law, and the country really became, you know, at the mercy of the corporate managers.
Now, slavery ended officially with the 13th Amendment, which I think was 1867?
Something like that, yes.
And a few years after that, there was a very famous Supreme Court case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad in 1886. Can you talk about what that case was about?
Well, the case was a tax case. I mean, the county of Santa Clara was trying to tax the railroad company, different from the way it taxed people. And the lawyers for the railroad company basically said that violated the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the phrase in there about equal protection. And the Supreme Court agreed. And I think this was part of a pattern of many cases where the Supreme Court, basically interpreting the Constitution, amended the Constitution. This was 1886. In the same period, the Supreme Court was eviscerating the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in many ways by, you know, using decisions in cases before it to nullify, to say it doesn't mean what it says. They were nullifying all kinds of civil rights laws and doing a bunch of other things. So the Supreme Court was acting as it was meant to do. It was responsible to a certain class of people, and these were people who were brought up in a certain way, these judges. Many of whom have been corporate lawyers, and some of whom had been trained all of them had training while the country had been a slave nation. So none of them were Democrats, you know, little Democrats. And when the opportunity came up in the Santa Clara and other cases dealing with providing occasion for the court to, you know, wrap the Constitution, you know, deeper and deeper around, or more comprehensively, around the people running corporations. It did so, and it did so. If you compare even in that period, in the second half of the 19th century, the cases dealing with labor that came to the courts and the cases dealing with corporations that came to the courts, you see a total opposite in their approach, that pretty much whenever, you know, cases dealing with worker rights came up, the courts would strike it down. Actually, women's rights, women trying to vote, a woman in Illinois who went to law school trying to become a lawyer to take the bar exam and being denied. The court, the free speech cases, pretty much the court generally decided against people trying to vindicate their rights under various parts of the Constitution, and generally did vindicate the rights of people operating in corporations. And that meant that the corporations were then enabled to go on denying the rights of people, because it's kind of self-evident that when a giant corporation, particularly a giant corporation, wields the First Amendment and speaks, when General Motors speaks, when Kodak Company speaks, it's much louder than when Bill Houston speaks.
So when you talk about corporate speech, do you mean corporate speech in the form of advertising and commercials, or corporate speech in terms of, I've even heard this applied to political campaigns, like that financial contributions to political campaigns has been equated to speech?
Well, I'm talking about both, but commercial speech is important, but let's focus on political speech. I mean, when a corporation contributes to a campaign, whether it's cash money, whether it's indirect money, or whether it's advertising, whether it's contributing to a magazine or to a think tank that's publishing stuff, contributing to conferences, you know, that's a form of speech. And it is now protected under the First Amendment, according to the courts. But if we're the people and we're having an election, how can this corporation, this sort of legal creation, this fiction that we the people created through our states, if we're really seeking to have a democracy, how can we have that entity, which has concentrated a lot of power and wealth, then interfering in our elections? It doesn't speak for the shareholders. A corporation doesn't poll all the shareholders to see how they feel about things before they advocate their position and stuff like that. So, I mean, you have corporations denying the rights of its workers. It's pouring its effort into the body politic to influence ideas, to write history, to propagandize in general, to tell us, you know, what the right values are, what to think, to define the problems of our time. And when corporations do that, we mere mortals have a very hard time being heard, raising money, in any way competing with that. I mean, just look at the contributions to any major campaign, or even minor campaign, and the people are usually outspent enormously by corporate money.
It's funny that you say mere mortals, because one of the features of the modern corporation is that it has infinite duration.
Well, that's right. We live, we die, and corporations go on and on and on, and, you know, so that the people who come in there are relatively interchangeable. I mean, they go on forever. But, you know, it's a strange thing that it's sort of generally unchallenged and generally accepted. I mean, the fact that, you know, that corporations have constitutional rights, that corporations exist forever, that corporations play a major role in the governance of our communities, of our states, of our country, and that there's very little we can do about it. For example, in Massachusetts in the 70s, people ran an initiative in the state to ban corporate contributions to referendums and initiatives that the corporations didn't have a stake in. So it was a modest initiative, and it won. And immediately some banks and other corporations sued, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the banks were right. The people of Massachusetts did not have the right to pass this initiative because it violated the corporation's First Amendment freedom of speech.
Wow.
You know?
And you said that was originally passed by referendum?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, you know, there are many, many other cases like that where people have actually passed laws. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of laws at a state, local, and some at the federal level that people organize for 10 years or 15 years, and they pass a law that tries to define the corporation in a more limited fashion. And the Supreme Court is in the position, with 5 votes, basically to throw it out and say, well, this law is unconstitutional, or this law doesn't exactly say what the words say on the paper.
So let's go back briefly to the... Kevin has a question. Kevin, go ahead.
First of all, Richard, congratulations on the upcoming 10th anniversary of Polklad.
Oh, thank you very much.
And could you tell us a little bit about the development of Polklad and what are some of the principal goals you folks have for the upcoming future?
Well, I guess one of the principal goals was to provoke debate and action about the illegitimate authority of corporations to govern, I mean, very much the topic that we've been discussing tonight. And I think in various pockets around the country, these issues are now being talked about, and that in a few places, civic organizing is evolving in a new way, trying to build upon the historical information and analysis that a growing number of people, not just in Polklad, but a growing number of people have been exploring. In the future, I think that's where people's interest is what does it mean to rethink, and structure an organizing campaign that begins to challenge, not only deal with the particular harm, let's say there's whether it's a toxic chemical or genetically engineered foods or whatever, but also begins to expose and challenge these, what we call illegitimate constitutional rights that corporations have, and the complicity, and even beyond complicity, of public officials in enabling corporations to deny people's rights. So in a few places, there are some things happening where small towns are starting to pass laws that deal with a particular corporate harm, but in a way that seeks to strip the corporations of authority, of this history.
Like what happened in Porter Township, Pennsylvania?
That's right.
Can you talk about what did happen in Porter Township, Pennsylvania?
I think Porter Township is a small township in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania, where the township supervisors passed the law said within our township, the corporation does not have constitutional rights. And that came out of 5-6 years of organizing around some other issues where people realized that no matter what the laws they had passed, as long as corporations could stand on the Constitution and bring lawsuits, they could undo or seriously threaten those laws. And so they decided to go the step further and take the corporation straight on, really to provoke them. And what happens on a sort of human level, on a cultural level, what that means is that the people who are, the corporate spokespeople and politicians and all the very important people who are from the corporate side, they have to come into that community, which they do, to say, you have no right to do this. You don't have the authority to pass such a law. This may be a democracy, but it doesn't go that far. And I think that that's when you have important people come to your town and say that, it's a very provocative moment. And people, pushes people even further into the democratic process. And some of the prior stuff there was that the factory farming had become a big issue in Pennsylvania. And a number of communities had started passing laws banning the corporate ownership of farms and farmland. It turns out that's a classic mechanism both to stop the corporate farming, but also to put on the table and challenge pretty openly the claim that corporations have equal rights or more rights than people. And I think in the coming years we're going to see many more examples of very creative thinking and organizing on a whole range of issues where basically people are pulling together the common thread of all these issues, no matter what they are, whether it's dealing with corporatization of water or mining or clear cutting of trees or whatever. The underlying thread through all of these issues is by what authority do public officials give the people running corporations special powers to wield the law and the Constitution against the rest of us? And we say by no legitimate authority.
Richard?
Yes.
This is Mike Hudak, co-host with Bill Houston.
Good evening.
Hi. I wonder if you could speak about the Enron scandal. Has that been useful in your organizing?
Not very much, because both the corporate press and politicians are very, very skilled at framing issues like that. And they framed it as corporate excess. And I mean, it was the thievery parts, the sort of stuff that, they broke a lot of laws. They also didn't break a lot of laws. But I've seen very little in the corporate press or from corporate politicians, about the reality that most of the things that the Enron officials did mm-hmm. was perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. And one of the big areas in which they operated was they set out to change state and federal law on energy, really to reconfigure how we think about energy in this country. And to do that, they used the 200 years of history, the fact that they were legal persons, that they could use an enormous amount of money to get involved in elections, to go into legislatures and lobby, give money to think tanks in order to come up with the papers they need, stories to the press. What they did was to propagandize in order to change values, in order to change the law, in order to do what they wanted to do. And it wasn't because they were so brilliant. It was because they stepped into the result of a long history that enabled the people and corporations to do that. And so the remedy was the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, which requires a little more accountability or openness in the corporate CEOs now have to sign the financial statements and stuff like that. But none of it is about this whole question of corporate constitutional rights, about what a corporation is, how the people within a corporation are, in fact, denying us mortals of our rights.
Right.
So it was clear from the beginning that would, it was not going to be easy to use the Enron case.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of your own organizing, as you've just described here. But using the Enron case as an example of what's wrong with the fundamental structure of corporations.
Well, we talked about it a little bit. I mean, Enron, it turns out that Enron Corporation is chartered in Oregon. And so think about it, it's actually kind of funny that the people of Oregon, through their state legislature, charter the Enron Corporation. And because of the laws in Oregon, the corporation itself then is able to create other companies. So they created these other, three, four, five, God knows how many thousand entities, some corporations, some partnerships, whatever, offshore, onshore. And early on, I was trying to advocate that it is, in fact, the governor and legislators and attorney general of Oregon who were culpable here, that they're the ones who unleashed Enron on the rest of the country, and they had a responsibility either to fix it or the people had a responsibility to go after them and get them for the culpability. But I frankly couldn't get too many folks interested in that concept.
Well, it seems like that I'm aware of a case that Poklad, I believe, is assisting with in the district courts in Pennsylvania right now, where the defendants are partly the state of Pennsylvania themselves. And I think that my research has shown that you're using the 14th Amendment in a unique way, and that is to say that the state of Pennsylvania has misused the 14th Amendment to grant corporations rights, which is rather interesting because the 14th Amendment has been used ever since Santa Clara to grant corporations rights of persons.
Right. It's complicated because we and anybody else that's filing suits against corporations, you're turning to the courts and sometimes to the legislatures for a remedy. But it is, in fact, just as you say, it is the courts that have given the 14th Amendment, and the First Amendment and other parts of the Constitution to the men and women in corporations to wield against us. And it is the state legislatures which have also, in their corporate codes, declared that corporations shall have the rights of have the legal rights of persons. So we're trying to raise that and turn it back on them, but we're asking those very people, the very institutions that have empowered corporations to deny our rights, to do something about it.
So we're going to the wolves to complain about some missing hens.
Right. Well, that's another parallel to what happened during slavery. I mean, slavery was legal in this country. Therefore, the law was about enabling a few people, plantation owners, to enslave a whole class of people and deny them their rights. And there was no remedy. And even, as over a couple of generations, an abolitionist movement built up. This is, I think, a lesson that I'm hoping that there's some people out there that are listening to. So over the course of a few generations, the abolition movement builds up, and the slave owners wouldn't budge. I mean, there was no remedy to slavery. It was written into the Constitution. It was in the culture. The slave-owning South controlled the national government, basically. There was no remedy. And if the slave-owning class was not going to even negotiate, what we ended up with was one of the greatest, awfulest, bloodiest wars in history. And I think we're in a similar situation, is that there is no remedy now because the corporate state and, all the mechanisms of governance are part of the corporate state. And they are the ones who have created this reality. I heard Senator Kerry a couple of weeks ago say, you know, when outsourcing was the story of the week, to say that there's nothing constitutionally the government can do, legislatures can do, about outsourcing. But what does that mean? You know, it means, can my community really make the rules about the economy in my community? We can't now. That has been one of the purposes, you know, one of the uses of our Constitution, which has been to deny majorities of people in their own communities or states from making the rules, to making the rules about how money is invested, how work is organized, how goods are produced and sold and all that. We cannot make the rules for that. And so what we end up doing is trying to, we pass the Clean Air Act, and we try to make what they're doing a little less bad. And we think, you know, early on in Polkla, we felt, well, that it wasn't good enough for the language of the Declaration of Independence for a country that's supposed to be a self-governing democracy. You know, when a majority gets together and says, this is the way we want to do it, it should have the authority to do that.
It almost sounds like you're describing Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where the master loses control of the monster that he created.
Well, you know, except maybe we didn't create it. You know, sometimes our stories, our myths, don't align with reality. And I'm comfortable with the story being, you know, we start off as a slave state, and that morphed into a corporate state. And it's always been a relatively, you know, one class of people, a relative small number of people, that have made the rules to make the rules. And so it's pretty logical that we ended up this way. And if we want to change it, it's very important to resist each of the harms, because humanity cries out that we do that. Because as Eugene Debs says, if we don't resist each harm, we become as slaves. But, you know, we have now, you know, particularly in the last 30, 40, 50 years, we have a lot of evidence, we have a lot of data that tells us if we keep just resisting each harm without opening up the bigger questions, without looking historically, without challenging all this illegitimate power that is wielded against us and our communities and the earth by a relatively few, you know, small number of people camouflaged in these corporations, then we can't keep up. And anybody that's had any experience with organizing in communities knows that we're always on the defensive. You know, there's always something else, some other corporate cockamamie idea coming down the pike that, you know, it's another technology, it's another store, it's another this, another that. And people gear up and say, we're going to stop this, we're going to stop GE Foods, we're going to stop nuclear power, we're going to, you know, stop redlining, we're going to stop whatever. You know, we're always on the defensive. Well, when do we get to talk about our vision for how our communities and our society can be organized? Why should it take 100 years for a majority to say, this is how we want to do things? And how can we have a few judges say, you know, when a majority finally passed the law to say, sorry, this is about the economy, this is private law, you have no authority to even be mucking around in these realms.
Richard, let's say that some of our listeners have been interested or had their curiosity piqued by what you're saying this evening. What would you suggest to them as some first steps if they're new to this perspective or field?
Well, they can. The program on corporations, law, and democracy has a bunch of stuff. The books that Bill mentioned, Defining Corporations, Defining Democracy, would be a good book to start with. It's a bunch of very short pieces, none of them longer than 3 or 4 or 5 pages. So you can pick it up and just browse through it, you know, one at a time. My colleague Peter Kelman has a book called Building Unions, a booklet, which, you know, looks at some of this from a labor perspective, that's available. We have a, you know, reading list that people can take a look at. I'd say anywhere you want to get into this, there's something, some aspect of what corporations are doing that has intrigued you or angered you, whatever. If you start looking at it with an open mind and not get sucked totally into the technological details of the particular harm, and start thinking about, in the context of the discussion we've been having tonight, about, you know, how does this look in the context of the language of democracy, the language of consent of the governed, the language of majority rule? There's a huge literature now, and I would say start taking a look at it. On a more practical standpoint, we've started in collaboration with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in Pennsylvania, who's worked on some of these laws in Pennsylvania, what we call Democracy School, which is a weekend school where we go into this stuff in depth. So if people are interested in that, they should contact Polkla at 508-398 1145, and the email is people@poclad.org.
And there's also a website at that address, poclad.org.
That's right. It's a very good website. You mentioned that we're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary. Compared to 10 years ago, there's far more literature available online, offline, in books, pamphlets, articles than there was. And I think a lot more excitement in that there's more groups of people who are actually talking about these things in the context of, not purely as a theoretical discussion, but in the context of, all right, what does that mean that we in our community can do differently tomorrow that might help us be more effective civic activists and more effective citizens whose job it is, in fact, to participate in the governing of our communities.
Richard, are you optimistic that the people might someday form a democratic form of government?
Sure. What option do I have besides optimism?
Yeah. We're about out of time. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show. I understand that you're featured in a new film. Is that correct?
Featured, I think, is a bit of an overstatement. I appear in a film called The Corporation by a Canadian filmmaker named Mark Akbar,
uh-huh.
who made Manufacturing Consent.
That's right, the Chomsky film.
You're right. It soon will be opening in the U.S. There are 3 hours of outtakes of me. I wish they'd used more than the 1.5 minutes they used. But yes, I'm in the film.
Maybe there will be a DVD version with those outtakes in it.
Oh, and special interviews with everybody, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Richard, thank you so much for being on the show, and we really appreciate all the good work you're doing up there in, with POCLAD.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, this has been Radio Free Press with Bill Houston.
And Mike Kudak.
And over there in Studio A is Kevin Bunger. He's being quiet, but he's there. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.